I read a fascinating article about the nature of learning, and particularly with regard to memory. And as I recall, I think I do remember the first one, they were saying that typically, you know, your average human being is going to be able to remember about 10% of what they hear. So if you only involve one of the senses and one part of your being, and that is your hearing, you're only going to remember about 10%. So when you come in here, you sit down, you listen to me talk, and you walk out, what have you got?
10%.
About 5 minutes worth of data out of an hour. Well, that's tragic. So then they said, though, it was surprising, and I remember it was quite a leap, that if you hear a thing and you see it, you remember it jumps up like 25%. It was really a very significant leap. Hence, so many slides and overheads and all the stuff, you know, that you see me do, because I'm trying to present the information not just through your ears, but also through your eyes, because we're involving two different senses now, and we're therefore naturally elevating retention, and therefore the impact that it has on your life long term. Then they added, and this is not quite like your senses anymore, but they said they had learned through various studies that if you hear a thing and you see a thing and you say a thing, if you speak it, then once again your retention leaps quite a bit. Hence, you all know, been here 5 years, how often I'm saying don't read the scriptures to yourself. Read them out loud. Every opportunity you have, read out loud. I read Isaiah out loud in my backyard this afternoon, hoping the neighbors had to overhear it. Okay, so you hear it, you see it, and you say it. If you feed back what you have heard by saying it, then again you get this quantum leap in retention, therefore usefulness in your life. But the next one was, if you hear it, you see it, you say it, and then you do something about it. Well, saying is already doing something, but if you get out physically somehow and you practice it, then you get the highest level of impact in your life. You get the highest degree of memory and therefore application and for the long haul. So, you know, a teacher that's aware of these kinds of things thinks about these things and would like as much as possible to involve hearing, seeing, saying, and then doing, right? Please, if you are capable, stand up. Everybody. Now, you don't have to. I can understand some may not be able to, but please stand up if you can. All right, here we are. Do not say anything. Everybody be quiet. Think first. If I can get this to work. What century is Isaiah living in? You don't say anything. First you think about it. Okay. Now somebody raise your hand if you think you know what century Isaiah was in. Okay. Linda?
780.
Okay, well, you are correct. What I was looking for was 8th century, so that would be then the 700s. So you're correct. If you knew it was the 8th century, remain standing. If you didn't, sit down in shame. Okay. Woo! All right, well, Linda did it, so stand up. All right. Now, is it the first half or the last half of the 700s that Isaiah is living in? First half or seventh half? If you knew the first one, you're still standing. First half or seventh half of the 8th century B.C.? It is the second half, 750 to 700. If you knew that, you stay up. If you didn't know that, you sit down. Okay? How many years did Isaiah prophesy? It's a big spread. We don't know for sure. It was 40 to 60 years. If you knew it was somewhere in those two decades, 40 to 50, 60 years, stay up. If not, sit down. Eileen! This is great. Who was prophesying with Isaiah? Him stands for... Hosea,
Isaiah,
and Micah. It's only Micah or Malachi that you can pick from. Still she's up. What kings did Isaiah deal with in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah? Remember this. You might find yourself standing again. Okay, so those kings are Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Was Isaiah married or single? I know this is hard because it was, you know, the last Wednesday in May when we did this introductory information, we got interrupted a couple of times. He's married. He's married. Does he have kids or are they childless? He has kids. How many? He has two children. They're going to figure highly and be living examples of Isaiah's prophecies. He has two children. Is Isaiah a rural or an urban prophet? Is he out in the country or is he a city guy? Isaiah. Isaiah's a city guy. What city would that be? Jerusalem, primarily. Is he a royal type of guy or is he a regular kind of a guy? Does he hobnob with the kings a lot? Is he somebody who has influence with the kings? Is he a part of the king's court? Or is he just, you know, like Amos, I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet, I'm, you know, tending to the trees. Which was he? He is a royal guy. And as a matter of fact, thought maybe to actually have been related to the king Uzziah. Though we're not totally sure about that. I don't think I even mentioned it back then. So, what is the reigning world superpower at this time? That is Assyria. All right? But what empire will succeed them? Who's coming up? Who's coming in behind Assyria? It's the next letter of the alphabet. Babylon. So, AB. Assyria and then Babylon. What century is Isaiah in? The 8th. First half or last half? Last half. How many years did he prophesy? 40 for sure, maybe as many as 60, something even longer. Who was prophesying with him? Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. What case did he deal with? Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Married or single? Married. Kids? Yes. How many? Two. Rural or city? City. What city? Jerusalem. So, he's a royal kind of a guy. Assyria's reigning. Babylon is forming and on the rise, but it'll be 100 years before they're a superpower, but they're, you know, they're up-and-comers. Now, I mentioned this, I've been saying this, but I wanted to actually put it up on the screen here. Who are the four contemporary prophets? Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. The hymn thing, you know, that's the memory trick there, has more than one purpose. In Amos 1:1, these are the words of Amos, who was among the chief herders from Tekoa, which he envisioned visions concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake, which earthquake we know nothing about, but it was a big deal back in their time now. What king did he say he prophesied during the reign? How many did he mention? Well, Amos only mentions one, and it's the first one. It's Uzziah. So apparently he didn't prophesy outside Uzziah's reign. But I have to be careful. In that verse, the first verse of Amos, are there two kings mentioned? Yes. Uzziah is named first. He's the king of what? Judah. And in the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. But if Uzziah is king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, is the king of Israel. So, is Uzziah reigning in the north or in the south? Uzziah is reigning in the south. Over how many of the original 12 tribes? Two. And they are, one of them's named Judah. What's the other one? It's Benjamin, as a matter of fact. Okay, Jeroboam, son of Joash, is king of Israel, but the term Israel by this time, because the kingdom divided in 930 BC, when Rehoboam was such a foolish son of Solomon, since it's been divided now for 200 years, Israel in the north is a name, Israel, that's being fairly exclusively attributed to the northern 10 tribes. Judah is what they're calling the two in the south. Benjamin just kind of got absorbed and forgotten, you know, name-wise. And in the north, you had 10 tribes, and so they just called it Israel. What is the other name for Israel? If you want to mention 10 tribes under one name, and you don't use Israel, what do you use?
Ephraim.
Good for you. Ephraim. So you're going to see Ephraim, and it'll mean 10 tribes, not just one. You're going to see Israel, and it'll mean 10 tribes and not 12. You'll see Judah, and it means 2 tribes and not 1. Including Benjamin. Okay, so Amos names himself after 2 contemporary kings, and he picks one in Judah and one in Israel. But it doesn't get outside that time frame. Hosea begins with, "The word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah." So how long did Hosea prophesy? Something akin to Isaiah. At least he's touching all 4 of those kings. Now those kings span a tremendous amount of time, something like 80-some-odd years, but you know, you don't know if it's the beginning of the first one or the end, or the beginning of the last one or the end, and so at least he's touching in essentially the very same time frame. And during the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. Okay?
Was Jeroboam the last king of the north?
This is Jeroboam II, by the way. Jeroboam II. And, I don't know. That's why I didn't put that question up. I can't remember who the last king of Israel was. Oh, you know, I'll be able to show you in a minute. Hold on, I'll be able to show it to you. Okay, so in Isaiah we saw the vision of Isaiah, son of Amos, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now Isaiah, he doesn't mention Jeroboam at all, does he? Amos and Hosea, they get down to this Jeroboam II. Isaiah doesn't even mention him. And then the last one, of course, can be Micah, the word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So now, we started off with Amos, and he mentions Uzziah, but none of the successors. And by the time we get to Micah, he doesn't even mention Uzziah. He just gets 3 of the successors. So now you see why we say him instead of or something else. A myth. Or something like that when you get a rear anchor. The him works out kind of nicely anyway, because it's also chronological. I hadn't pointed that out before. But Amos clearly is at the beginning and not at the end. And so the overlapping that's taking place here is with Amos first, and then Hosea, and then Isaiah, and then Micah. There's another thing you can notice about this. Here in Isaiah's statement, he's the first of these to not mention Jeroboam. Now, Bill asked, was Jeroboam the last one? I'll show you here in just a second. We'll see. You know, but if Isaiah lived throughout the whole second half of the 8th century, then dead center, more or less, in that half century, what happens in 722? In 722, what happens? Assyria comes in, and what do? They take away the 10 northern tribes, never to be seen again. So is anybody going to be referencing the kings of Israel or the kings of Ephraim, whichever term you want to use, after 722? No, because there aren't any. Okay? So Isaiah's prophecy, it's the very first verse, gives us this clue that he is spanning in that second half of the 8th century the fall of the 10 northern tribes. And the word of the Lord, according to Micah, which came to Micah in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, doesn't say anything about the 10 tribes of the north. Except his prophecy was concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Now Isaiah's Judah and Jerusalem. But what did Micah say? He put Samaria in there. So what do you know about Micah if he's prophesying to Samaria? He must have started before 722 B.C., when there still was a Samaria. After that, wiped out. So the word of the Lord came to Micah, Moresheth, days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. It's after the time frame of Uzziah, but also before the time frame of the fall. Now, here's that chart, and the answer to your question is, here's Jeroboam the second, Bill. After him, we got Menahem, Pekahiah, Pekah, and Hoshea, and Hoshea is the last one. So, there's another test question, now that I remember it. I'll use that one too. And here in 722 is when that Assyrian captivity and total destruction takes place. So, and I had some circles here. There's Amos, Hosea. Now what do you notice about Isaiah and Micah? It's not just that they're turned on their sides, which we do because they span a long time frame. But what do you notice? Amos and Hosea are on the left side of the chart because who still exists? Israel. But on the right side, Isaiah and Micah, they're put over here as prophesying to Judah, though Isaiah certainly did live during that time before the kingdom fell. Okay? And as we pointed out, I can't know for sure, but something like 40 to 60 years for Isaiah. Now, last chart we'll have for the evening, last thing we want to say along the lines of introductory material, trying to stitch together, classes going clear back to May here, as I was off to Israel for a month and we skipped last week. But again, I did not point this out, but I'd like very much for you to try to remember this little tidbit that I'm showing you now. Isaiah has how many chapters? 66. Clearly, they are divided into two very distinct sections. He preached for a long time. And the book that is then collected of his prophecies, all these various prophecies, are gathered together into a single book. We need 66 chapters, and some of the prophecies are longer than a single chapter, but when we get them together, clearly, the first 39 are of a different nature than the last 27. The first 39 are different than the last 27 in Isaiah chapters. Why did I put books on my chart? Where do you have 39 books? In the Old Testament, and 27 books in the New Testament. Now, I want to be very careful. I am not saying that God decided that he wanted to match the books and give you a neat memory trick that the 39 books of the Old Testament is a handy way to remember that primarily, though certainly not exclusively, and especially as we'll see in Isaiah 2 in just a minute, most of that material in those first 39 books is about Old Testament time frames and events. It's for those people for their times because if they don't repent, then they are going to die or be taken into slavery. And a bunch of other nations as well. Isaiah is not just preaching Jerusalem and Judah. He is also going to be preaching to the north, and he's going to be preaching to a bunch of Gentile nations as well. But you ought to know that. It's a curiosity at least, and it does help as a memory trick. Clearly, the first 39 books of Isaiah are different than the last 39 chapters of Isaiah are different. So if you can remember that 39 and 27 for both Old and New Testament books, and then kind of Old Testament chapters and New Testament material for Isaiah, or at least Messianic and looking forward, it'll be helpful for you to kind of get around in the book. So primarily, Isaiah's first 39 chapters have to deal with those Old Testament times, and then 40 through 66 with New Testament times. Okay, so we'll turn this off and get into the book itself. And we saw 2 weeks ago in Isaiah 1:1 the statement, the vision of Isaiah the son of Amos concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. We do not know and do not need to know when a given book was written. We also do not need to know whether or not this first chapter is intended as being an overview statement for the whole book of Isaiah. I rather think it's not, though most people do. They look at this first chapter as being specifically designed as an introductory chapter to all 66 chapters of the book of Isaiah. But I don't necessarily see any reason, you know, to think that. It is true that more kings are mentioned. It says, though, Judah and Jerusalem very specifically. And then what do we find out about much of the 39 first chapters in Isaiah? Are they going to be exclusively about Judah and Jerusalem? No, he's going to talk about a wide array of nations. And so it's kind of hard for me to apply that first statement in that first chapter to the entire book as, you know, comprehensive of the whole book, when in fact it doesn't represent the book very well that way. I know that virtually every commentary does that. It, you know, bugs me a little. It doesn't seem to fit very well. I think the first chapter is much more limited to Judah and Jerusalem. And we saw last time, 2 weeks ago, the Lord was not happy. Look at verse 10. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of what? Say it. And you remember it better. Sodom, give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah haven't been around for 1,200 years. Not since the days of Abraham. 1,200 years, 12 centuries they've been gone. Okay? So how can you say you rulers of Sodom and Gomorrah? Because you're that wicked. Your leaders are that wicked. And there is just a blast of criticism throughout the first chapter. And then after that terrifying blast of criticism and condemnation, we get this in chapter 2, verse 1. The word which Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And the same thing he said in the preceding chapter's first verse. But now he says, it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and be raised above the hills. And all the nations will come to it. Now, I want you all to stay right there in Isaiah. I'm going to turn quite a few pages, and I'm going to start reading from Micah chapter 4. And in Micah chapter 4, while I read Micah, you all stay right there and you look at Isaiah. I'm going to read Micah 4:1 and keep going. And you're going to read Isaiah chapter 2 verse 1 and keep going. Here's what Micah said. And it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills and the peoples will stream to it. And many nations will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Huh. What did you notice? Well, it's just almost verbatim, isn't it? In fact, I don't know that there's even half a dozen words that are different. And the sense is absolutely identical. Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah, they have known each other. They were contemporary prophets. And when the Holy Spirit of God moves a prophet to speak, does the Spirit have permission to have two different prophets say the same thing? Oh, sure. And so, Micah, along with Isaiah, both of them apparently now living in the times after the northern kingdoms had fallen, they're going to be saying exactly the same thing about the what days? The last days. You may have latter days, depending on your translation. So then, when you read the term, the last days in your Bible, to what does that refer? Now, before you say, well, you mean in Isaiah, I'm just saying, is the term the last days exclusively reserved for one particular time in world history? No. It just means the last days. So what's your next question? Of what? The last days of what? Because there's lots of last days. There's last days of all kinds of kingdoms that come to an end. There's last days of cities. Last days just means last days, and only the context will tell you what last days that we're talking about. Fortunately, when we get over to Isaiah, well, first let me put it this way, when we get to Hosea, and then when we get to Acts chapter 2, both of them are going to use that term. Peter in Acts 2, quoting from Hosea, and when Hosea uses that term last days, and Peter quotes it in Acts chapter 2, what does Peter start off by saying? This is what Nigel said. So, Hosea's last days are identified by Peter as being what time frame in relation to us? To millenniums ago. Not ahead of us, but behind us by 2,000 years. Because we're talking then about the last days of what? 2,000 years ago, we had the last days and we had the first days. What were the last days? The last days of?
Well, I think it's the last days of the Jewish system.
The last days of Moses' law. The last days of the Old Covenant. The last days of animal sacrifice and Levitical priesthood and temple worship. The last days of the very carnal, materialistic, and physical Old Testament, which is being replaced by what? Christianity. Jesus the Christ. The fulfillment of all of those things. Isaiah and Micah, having talked about terrible punishment, judgment, disaster, cataclysm, and catastrophe that would fall upon these people in their lifetime. They then follow that, here in Isaiah 2, with a very promising thing. The mountain and the house of the Lord is established as the chief, raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it. And the minute you hear all nations, then what do you know he's talking about? Jews. And the Gentiles. Everybody else. All nations is all nations, not just the Jews. And so you've got Isaiah looking to a time where all nations will be together in something. Does that exist so long as the Old Testament is in place? No. Because that law was for who? It's for the Jews. And until that law is done away, then you're not going to have a wholesale Jew and Gentile in a common, you know, religion. So, it'll be established as the chief of the hills, many nations and peoples. Let's go to the mountain of the Lord. Let's the house of the God of Jacob. Teach us concerning his ways, walk his path. Law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. That'll make you stand up if you're in the Acts class. Remember, I told you this. I didn't do this on purpose. I wish I'd been that brilliant. 2-3 years ago, I would say, you know, I need to teach Isaiah and Acts at the same time so that I can get to that place where they meet. And I'll do my introduction on Luke 24 and how he hands off into Acts chapter 1 and the two things that he says in the last chapter of one book, first chapter of the other, you know, that is a fulfillment of Isaiah 2. Well, I didn't do that on purpose, but how many of you were in the Acts class? So, you should have a pencil out. And certainly then, next to verse 3, in the last part of verse 3, you want to write Luke 24, verses 45 through 47. Because we had a big point out of that in the book of Acts. There was a prophecy that said that the fulfillment of the Old Testament, the coming of the Messiah, and this new religion that would include the Jews and the Gentiles, was going to start where? Acts chapter 1, verse 8. What's the first geographical location in Acts 1:8? Don't you dare look. It is Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and then what? The other parts of the earth. Okay? That's a prophecy about the progression of the gospel. And then in the book of Acts, what very specifically do you see? Where do we start? Jerusalem. Where's the gospel go next? Judah. And then it goes to Samaria, chapter 8, Philip, Ethiopian eunuch, and all this stuff, you know, is going to be involved. And then what happens? And then it goes to the remotest parts. Okay. So we get this wonderful promise. It's really good in verse 4. He'll judge between the nations. He'll render decisions for many peoples. He'll hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. Now, I heard just the funniest thing from Homer Haley. I've been listening to his classes on Isaiah as well as on Acts. And so I'm studying with Homer, you know, and listening to his class. And he just said the most wonderful thing here. He said, you know, when denominational churches go to apply this verse today, and they look also at Acts chapter 11, the lion lays down the lamb, you know, and all that, they look at it and they say, see, this has to do with the nations of the world in this chapter, and in chapter 11 with actual physical animals, and we're going to get a millennial kingdom one day where there's no war on planet Earth. And for 1,000 years, Jesus is going to reign out of Jerusalem in a rebuilt temple, and there will be no war whatsoever on planet. All the nations will get along together. Everybody be happy. There'll be no disease. And the lion plays with the lamb. And, oh, it's just going to be wonderful. And what Homer said was, he said, you know, it's like a guy who said he shot at a fish and missed the river. The stream of thought that we're dealing with right here, brethren, has to do with the replacement of the Old Testament with the New Testament, with the replacement of carnal, physical religion with a purely spiritual one that, thanks to Daniel, we learn is eternal. Nothing can destroy it because it's not of a physical nature. So, when they try to make this very physical, and they say, one of these days, you know, Putin over there, he's going to get out, you know, and big hand hurt and beat his ceremonial sword into a plowshare and go out and become a farmer. We don't have to worry about Russia anymore. There'll be no more war. Do these verses deal with anything like that? No, they don't. When they're applied later, they're not dealing with anything like that. They're dealing with the coming of Christianity in the last days of what? The old covenant system. Now then, in verse 5, come, house of Jacob, let's walk in the light of the Lord. You've abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they're filled with influences from the east. Soothsayers like the Philistines strike bargains with the children of foreigners. Land's been filled with silver and gold. There's no end to their treasuries. Land's been filled with horses. There's no end to the chariots. Land's all been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. So the common man's been humbled, the man of importance has been abased, but do not forgive them. Enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased. The loftiness of man will be humbled. And the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day against everyone who is proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up that he may be abased. And it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, all the lofty mountains, all the hills that are lifted up, every high tower, every fortified wall, all the ships of Tarshish, against all the beautiful craft. The pride of man will be humbled. The loftiness of man will be abased. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols will completely vanish, and men will go into caves of the rocks and into holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord, before the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver, their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliff before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. Stop regarding man, whose breath is in his nostrils. For why should he be esteemed? For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread, the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan, the skillful enchanter. I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. The people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor, the youth will storm against the elder, the inferior against the honorable. When a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you shall be our ruler. These ruins will be under your charge. On that day will he protest, saying, I will not be your healer. For my house there is neither bread nor cloak. You should not appoint me ruler of the people. For Jerusalem has stumbled, and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not conceal it. Woe to them! For they brought evil on themselves. Say to the righteous that it will go well. They will eat the fruit of their actions. Woe to the wicked, badly, for what he deserves will be done to him. Oh, my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. Oh, my people, those who guide you, lead you astray, and confuse the direction of your paths. The Lord arises to contend and stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord God of hosts. I'm going to stop right there for just a minute. Brethren, obviously all that goes together. Obviously all of that is condemnation. Obviously all of that is threat and warning about a coming judgment. But, brethren, I don't think that he's talking about the end of the world. The last days that we were talking about had to do with the end of the Old Testament system. But it looks like to me, after that wonderful promise, not all will be lost, not all will be killed, not all will be enslaved, there will come this spiritual kingdom, we will see something better one day. He then immediately, brethren, I believe, returned to the people at hand. Who does he address in chapter 2, verse 5? Come, O house of Jacob. What is the house of Jacob? The 12 tribes of Israel. Okay? So at that point, he gave them four verses of promise and hope. Of an end result that would be magnificent and marvelous. But was that close? What century did Isaiah live in? Eighth, first half of the last half. Last half. And about three quarters of the way through that eighth century, in 722, what happened? The northern kingdom was taken totally away in Isaiah's lifetime. As a matter of fact, the Syrians even surrounded Jerusalem. They'd taken everything but the city. And it would have fallen except for what? A miraculous intervention of an angel who killed 185 Assyrian soldiers in a single night, and the Jews hadn't even lifted a hand in defense of their city. So, Sennacherib runs back home, his two sons kill him, and that's the end of that, until Babylon later. And what I'm trying to say is, brethren, is that God does, in both the Old Testament and the New, speak of things in the far distant future, but he doesn't limit himself to that. When did he send Isaiah? In the last half of the 8th century before Christ. So what do you think the majority of his book is going to be addressed to? And who's it going to involve? Who's supposed to repent? The people that are living with him. The people in that time frame. So in chapter 2 and verse 5, after the great promise, okay, so out there in the future there's this, but right now, you guys are in dire straits. You're so miserably unrighteous, you know, from time to time. What did he say throughout the first chapter? Sink from the soles of their feet to the top of their head, he said. The whole thing. Okay? These are the people that Isaiah is trying to keep from sin. He's trying to turn them back. This is his job. Okay? So God can mention the distant future. The whole book's not about that. This is about turning these people. Okay? So the remainder there, what we've just been reading in chapter 2, all the way into chapter 3 now, has to do with the people of that time. Now, just in case you ladies, you know, are wanting to march around the building three times in favor of equal rights and, you know, no gender distinctions and all that sort of thing, here it goes. Chapter 3, verse 16. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs. The Lord will make their foreheads bare. And that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, and undergarments, turbans, and veils. It'll come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth and branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword, your mighty ones in battle, and her gates will lament and mourn and desert it. She will sit on the ground. Who's he talking to? People of his day. But brother, why is it that so many horribly mistaken preachers in various churches today think that those verses are talking about us?
They don't take it in context.
It's because it sounds like us. It's because it sounds like us. And so, not knowing their Bibles very well, you know, and inventing premillennialism and all that stuff about a thousand years kingdom and all, they look at this and they say, well, you know, that must be talking about us. Now, brother, are any of the things that he mentioned, there's 21 different things related to feminine garb that he lists there. Is there any one of them that is a sin in and of itself? No. But what is he describing? It makes us think so much of us. And make no mistake, I'm saying in the church and out. I'm not saying us Americans. I'm saying us in this building. Why does it make us think of us? Because, brethren, this is the great and terrible temptation of all young, and often enough, not so young, women. Okay? It's the way of the world. It is carnal, material, physical, earthly, sensual, and devilish, to use the New Testament description. Now, what is it describing? It is describing women who spend their time buying and wearing and flaunting, hey, look at me. Aren't I beautiful? Oh, look at me. That's what's condemned. Materialism, carnality, worldliness. That kind of, why, I'm a supermodel to be. Oh, yeah? The things themselves are not sins. But the attitude that says, hey, look at me. Aren't I just something to see? And you walk around in a manner, and you dress in a manner, and you accoutre-size yourself. So that, the whole point is, hey, look at me, aren't I beautiful? That, brethren, is condemned. Now, I've seen an awful lot of women in church who knew how to dress. They dress in a manner that is modest, that is dignified, that is honorable, that is attractive. But it's not sensual. It's not, hey, look at me. It's not that head turner, watch me, at all. It's dignified. It's honorable. And therefore, incurs no condemnation or wrath from God. And women's dress is a dress in the New Testament as well. So take note, ladies. Take note especially from the time that girl reaches about fifth grade. Take note of your attitude, what you're thinking you want to portray to the world. Because if what it is the flesh, you are in deep trouble. Your mind is all wrong. You better fix that. Because that results in condemnation and destruction, Old Testament or New. not healthy, not spiritual minded, not a function of modesty, not a function of, hey, look at me, I'm a righteous woman. Hey, look at me, I'm prettier than the next one, aren't I? Two different ethics.
It reminds me of Nebuchadnezzar, not that he didn't give glory to God, but that he was full of himself.
Full of himself. So, that's a good chat. Wow, that is something, isn't it? And it gets worse in chapter 4. Seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, we'll eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach. Now, what is that? That verse really should have been in the third chapter. What is that? What is the reproach? It's not nearly so much in our culture. You know, in our culture, you're raised up, if you have more than two children, you're destroying the planet. Okay. But in their culture, what? More children, better. Okay? No children is a divine reproach, brought shame on these women. They felt bereft and grieved. So speaking of a day, the first verse of chapter 4 really belongs in chapter 3, speaking of a day of terrible destruction in which there's going to be the loss of all these carnal things, including the men who've gone off to war and have failed. Now, reminding everything up through chapter 4 in verse 1 is talking about times that those people will live through. Well, I'm sorry, Okay. Now, let's take up verse 2. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. It will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, which filth you find described where? In the last part of the third chapter, we just read it. It will come about that verse 4, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke and the brightness of a flaming fire by night, for over all the glory will be a canopy. There'll be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day, and a refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. Now, this is a problem for me and for everybody in chapter 4. At verse 2, it begins with, in that day. In that day. Now, ordinarily then, that would be the day of all this destruction, which in chapters 2 and 3 is a destruction that I think has to deal with. First, for the Assyrians coming in to take the northern 10 tribes, and 100 years later, 16 years later, what? What's the next nation with the B? Babylon. But the in that day and the branch of the Lord is difficult because we had a different day back in chapter 2, verse 2, didn't we? That day was looking to Christianity. And so it's difficult to tell if the in that day of chapter 4, verse 2 was supposed to go back to the day of 2, 1 through 4, or if it is to be directly related to the time right after the destruction that will come physically on all of Israel, north and south, eventually. Now, kind of the tiebreaker for me, though, and we don't have time to deal with it, but I hope you got your pencil out, is the term, the branch. Please get your pencil out. And in the margin, next to verse 2, somehow identify branch and then make the following references with regard to the branch. Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 10. Isaiah 11, 1 through 10. Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 5, FF means following to the end of the context. So 23, 5, and 2 Fs, 5 and following. And then, chapter 33 in Jeremiah, verses 14 through 18. And then, two chapters in Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 3, verse 8, and Zechariah chapter 6, verses 12 and following. Two F's for following, following to the end of the context. Okay? Now, how many of you remember when I preached those three sermons here? It was 5 years ago. Of course not. I don't either. I had to look it up in my records. But the branch, brethren, that's Jesus. And when you go and you look at those other passages, there's absolutely no doubt about it. The branch is Jesus. And so it breaks the tie for me, you know, that in that day, at chapter 4 and verse 2, is a problem, because really verse 1 should have gone with chapter 3, and then verse 2 should have been the start of chapter 4, because I think it changes the day that we're talking about to the day of the branch and Christianity again. Isaiah, in both sections, verse 39 chapters and the last 27, is going to be referencing Jesus a lot. He never forgets about Jesus. He never forgets about the Messianic kingdom. He's always offering hope to these people. But primarily, he's trying to turn them back from their sin because of the impending judgments of Assyria and Babylon that are surely coming. So you've got both going on, and sometimes it's kind of hard to tell them apart. I see the problem there. I grant that it is a problem. But the branch, brethren, that's Jesus. And so I just think it's unfortunate that we have a bad placement for a chapter break right there. And really, between 1 and 2, there are two different topics, is my take on it. Now, with just a couple of minutes, I'm really frustrated, and no time at all, I guess I won't get into chapter 5, but please go home and read chapter 5. I told Jerry we started, it was going to be real hard, we had a lot of announcements and stuff going on, but I would have liked to have gotten through chapter 5, because clearly chapter 6 is a new topic. So chapter 5 should go with this material. You go home, read chapter 5, 2 through 5, you know, really should be kept together, and then chapter 6 is also different. Okay, any quick comment or question? We're already past time. Isaiah. I called him last week the dean of the prophets. The other term that people use is the prince of the prophets, because his verbiage is what? It's just majestic and towering, and sometimes terrifying, but wonderful too. This is Isaiah, weeks to come. Thank you, class dismissed.